From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hannah Arendt was one of the most influential and controversial political theorists of the 20th century. A German Jew living through the rise of Nazi power in Europe, an emigre intellectual powerhouse in America. She coined the phrase, the banality of evil, a label for the unthinking obedience that can systematically destroy human rights. She put that label on a face of the Holocaust. A new film looks at the furious controversy that ensued and her reply. This hour on Point, revisiting Hannah Arendt. You can join us on air or online. Have you read Hannah Arendt, considered the banality of evil? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Barbara Sukowa plays Hannah Arendt in the new film, Hannah Arendt. Here she is at one point in the film addressing sharp criticism of her work at a lecture at the New School in New York City.
I am, of course, as you know, a Jew. And I've been attacked for being a self-hating Jew who defends Nazis and scorns her own people. This is not an argument. That is a character assassination. I wrote no defense of Eichmann, but I did try to reconcile the shocking mediocrity of the man with his staggering deeds. Trying to understand is not the same as forgiveness. I see it as my responsibility to understand. It is the responsibility of anyone who dares to put pen to paper on this subject.
Joining me now from New York is Pamela Katz. She wrote the screenplay for Hannah Arendt, critically acclaimed, and you heard just a little bit of it, a passage right there. It's her fourth collaboration with the film's German director, Margareta von Trotta. She's also an adjunct professor of film studies at the Tisch School of the Arts at NYU. Pamela Katz, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
A pleasure to be here.
And with us from New York is Roger Berkowitz, academic director at the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and the Humanities, and a professor of politics, philosophy, and human rights at Bard College. He's editor of Thinking in Dark Times, Hannah Arendt on Ethics and Politics. Roger Berkowitz, welcome to you as well. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks very much, Tom. It's a pleasure.
Pamela, you were right in the middle of the creation of this film. Why Hannah Arendt? Why now, after all these years? 1963, she wrote Eichmann in Jerusalem. And of course, she wrote much more before, and she wrote much more after. Why bring her back now in 2013, or I guess 2012 when it first came out in Germany?
Okay, well, there are kind of two answers to that question. The first is very simple. The legendary German director Margareta von Trotta approached me and said she was interested in making a film about Hannah Arendt, and I thought that that would be a tremendous opportunity because I knew that in her hands it would have integrity, would be intelligent, and would be profound. That was the easy part of the yes. The harder part was figuring out how to portray this dynamic woman in a way that not only honored her thought, her influence, but also her very enigmatic character and personality. And we searched for a very, very long time, actually, several years, reading everything we could, meeting everyone we could, and in trying to figure out how to illuminate Hannah Arendt. And once we landed upon the Eichmann years, I think we discovered two very important things. One was that a book for which she was most known in a popular sense, in a way, we were able, through the concept of the banality of evil, to illuminate a lot of her deeper and more profound thoughts. But at the same time, we were able to talk about her as a person who suffered a great deal of exile and loneliness in her life. She was thrown out of Germany as a Jew, imprisoned in France as a German. And when the controversy over her articles in The New Yorker exploded, she feared losing her third and final home, America, where she had been very, very happy.
Roger Berkowitz, pull the curtain back a little further for us here. A.O. Scott writes in the New York Times, our friend Tony Scott, that really his only critique of the movie was he wished it was a miniseries, sort of a Downton Abbey of what German Jewish emigre life. And one could imagine that Hannah Arendt's life was much bigger than this. A handful of years, though you can see why a filmmaker would go to this point in her life in the controversy, the notoriety that emerged right there. But give us the bigger picture of Hannah Arendt, who she was, what she stood for, what her mission was.
Yes. Well, Hannah Arendt, as you know, fled Germany in 1933 to France and then later to the United States. Her writing first when she got to the United States was largely about the war, calling for a Jewish army and working for Jewish cultural reconstruction. But her first major book is a book called The Origins of Totalitarianism, which has three chapters, one on anti-Semitism, one on imperialism, and one on totalitarianism. And the argument of that book is an attempt to try and understand intellectually and historically how such a thing could have happened, both in Germany and also at the same – a similar time in Soviet Russia. And you know, it's a complicated book. There's a lot of arguments. For one thing, she says anti-Semitism was part of it. But the core of that book in many ways is the imperialism chapter in which she argues that it's this – belonging to movements and this desire for global and world domination, this desire to, in a sense, overcome nations and local connectedness, this desire for infinite growth that imperialism and then today things like globalization represent, sprung the limits, the common sense, traditional, religious, village limits of common sense that had kept the world in check for thousands of years. And her whole life in many ways was an attempt to think about how we can live together with different people politically at a time when the old traditions and the old limits have been shattered. And this question of how to live what she calls without banisters, ohne Geländer in German.
How to this think idea, without banisters in particular.
Yes, and so the banisters were the old things like religion, traditions, customs. The things she said, people are always going to be bad. You're always going to have people do the wrong thing. But over time, people would come back to the basic agreed upon banisters, traditions. We live at a time now when those traditions are not even accepted as right by many people, and we can recreate them. And we now live in this time to think without banisters. And so much of her life was geared in that direction.
Pamela Katz, take us back to the more than a moment, but the moment you focus on in the film. Here we had Israeli Secret Service. Israel was still a young country. The war was not so far in the rearview mirror. The Mossad picked up Adolf Eichmann in Argentina, brought him to Israel to stand trial. And this is the moment at which you turn to Hannah Arendt. And what the New Yorker sends her to cover this trial. How does that go, Pamela?
Well, first of all, I think that it was she who asked to cover the trial.
Mm-hmm.
She'd missed Nuremberg, as she says in the film, and she had never seen a Nazi face to face. And in order, as Roger was just speaking about, to understand what had gone on, it was, of course, an incredible opportunity, if also at the same time a difficult, even horrific one, to confront these people in a personal way, to be able to see them. And it is indeed her confrontation with Eichmann that led to many of her larger ideas, because she was profoundly shocked by what she found. She did not go there with this concept in mind. It was something she discovered through her confrontation. She was surprised at his, as she coined the phrase, it's not thoughtlessness, as we call it. It's a German word, Gedankenlosigkeit, which means a profound inability to think. She calls him, again, as we talk about in the film, he's a nobody. He's like a ghost with a cold. And she worked very long to reconcile, as she says, the mediocrity of the man with the horror of his deeds. And it came through that personal confrontation, and it was shocking and surprising for her. And one interesting note, the actress Barbara Sukowa, who did also, in addition to us, a tremendous amount of reading and research, made the decision that she did not want to see the footage of Eichmann until we were actually filming, because she wanted to experience that same sense of surprise on the screen. And I think that that's very important to the film.
Looking at that man, sort of ordinary-looking man behind the glass, box in Jerusalem. Here's a scene from the film. Hannah Arendt, Barbara Sukowa, meets with her friends and intellectual contemporaries to talk about that trial of Eichmann. Discussion becomes heated when Arendt suggests that Eichmann was not an anti-Semite, was simply following orders. It's in German here.
Er beförderte Menschen in den Tod, aber er fühlte sich nicht verantwortlich dafür.
Arendt says he transported people to their deaths, but did not feel responsible for it. Once the trains were in motion, his work was done. She's questioned by another person there, Kurt Blumenfeld, her mentor, who asks if Eichmann feels guiltless. She says, yes, that's how he sees it. He's a bureaucrat. Anti-Semitism not at the heart of what he's doing, just following orders. But Pamela Katz, as you depict in the film, this what portrayal of Eichmann landed with there was a furious pushback to this notion of the banality of evil from many who read, or maybe didn't read, but heard that phrase of Arendt's analysis, Pamela.
Yes, I think it was mistaken by some as it was called a bizarre defense of Eichmann, which of course it was in no way a defense. It was again an attempt to reconcile the mediocrity of the man with the horror of his deeds. And I think that while there's up until today a great deal of discussion about whether or not she was right, I always like to say that that's kind of a discussion that leads nowhere. We have to ask, what do we learn from that theory? And the fact that it's debated so hotly today is only further proof of its enormous influence.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about German-Jewish emigre intellectual Hannah Arendt, political theorist famous for the phrase, the banality of evil. In a new film focused on the furor over her early 1960s interpretation of Nazism and the Holocaust, Pamela Katz is co-screenwriter of that film, along with its director, Margrethe von Trotta. It's just out in limited release in the United States. She joins us today from New York. And from New York, Roger Berkowitz is here, academic director of the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics at Bard College. He's reviewed the film. You can see his review, Lonely Thinking, Hannah Arendt, on film. There's a link to our website from the Paris Review. He's editor of Thinking in Dark Times, Hannah Arendt on Ethics and Politics. We've got plenty of callers and people writing in already here as well. On Facebook, Roger William writes to us. He says, the idea that evil can become commonplace and routine, banal, is abhorrent to loving and compassionate people. The idea fills me with fear and loathing. The idea that torture, starvation, trauma would fail to arise compassion and action on the part of any good person is terrifying to me. Can humans really become that demonic? And one more, Roger. Luke writes, drone operators in Nevada make this choice every day or so. Making a connection there between those who go home for dinner and then do drone warfare during the day. But what about William's question? He says, it's abhorrent. How could it be? Can humans really be that demonic? Well, how about it, Roger?
Well, first of all, it's an excellent question. And Hannah Arendt, nor anyone with any mind, would ever say that evil is commonplace or mild. In fact, that's exactly the opposite of what she's trying to say. There are different kinds of evil. There's evil when I, you know, get mad at my colleague and stab him 10 times in the breast, and that's a kind of evil. What she's saying is there's a specifically modern kind of evil that really never existed before. I mean, there've been war crimes since the Greeks and before, and there've been crimes of genocide. I mean, people have and kill whole populations in war. But there's a new kind of crime that emerged in Nazi Germany and in Stalin's Russia. Let's keep that in mind as well. And that's a crime in which you, through administrative means, decide to eliminate entire populations based on some innocent criteria, not because they're bothering you or because they're in your way or they're fighting you, but just for some – because it fits in with your mission, your movement, as I was saying before, these movement mentalities that Nazism and also communism were at that time. And Arendt is trying to understand, to use a word Pam was just using, and reconcile, to make sense of how it is that for the first time in the history of the world, this new kind of evil, this horrific evil, can happen. And she's not saying it's – you know, that it's mild. She's saying it's the opposite. What she's trying to do is say, why? How could it happen? And what she's saying is, okay, anti-Semitism was part of it. And let me just say that, you know, she never says and never would have said that Eichmann was not an anti-Semite. She knows he's an anti-Semite. What she says is that while he was an anti-Semite, what drove him, what motive – he was a regular guy. He joined the SS because he needed a job. He was more of a joiner. Lots of people were anti-Semites. What made him specifically predisposed to be the chief of the Gestapo unit in charge of the Jewish situation was his desire to fit in and, in a sense, his desire to go along with the requirements of his job, his unwillingness to stop and oppose and think and stand apart. In a sense, his lack of arrogance, his lack of willingness to stand apart from the crowd. And what she says is while anti-Semitism was part of it, the bigger part of it was this, what she calls Gedankenlosigkeit, this unwillingness to stop, think, and in a sense say, well, this is not the way I was taught, the way I was brought up. I'm going to resist in some way.
And I think this is a good point to bring up a very important scene in the film, which actually took place at the trial. And that's where the judge, the German Jewish judge, takes off his headphones and asks to address the defendant in his own language. And he asks him, had there been more civil courage, could things have gone differently if you had had more civil courage? And Eichmann responds, well, yes, of course, if that civil courage had been hierarchically organized.
Yeah.
And that's the moment, I think, where Hannah Arendt must have realized what she called his inability to think. A man who could connect civil courage with hierarchical organization is somebody who didn't, as she put it, think what he was doing.
But then, of course, there were those who said she simply mistook his demeanor for the humility of a clerk or the unthinkingness of a drone at work. We've got tape of that moment. This was Eichmann at trial, 1961 in Israel. Here he is defending his role in the Holocaust, saying he felt a kind of split between his duty and his consciousness, that it was useless to resist.
Es ist eine Frage des menschlichen Verhaltens und sicherlich ist es nun so gewesen, es war die Kriegszeit, Turbulenz.
The actual voice of Adolf Eichmann, he was in charge of all the logistics undergirded the Holocaust. And he's saying here, it's a question of human behavior? Of course it was. It was wartime upheaval. Everyone thought it's useless to resist. A drop on a hot stone that evaporates without purpose or success or failure or anything, it was connected to the times, I think, to the times how children were raised with ideological education, rigid discipline, that sort of thing. But we have seen in years since him quoted earlier, Eichmann saying, I worked relentlessly to kindle the fire of anti-Semitism, Roger. I was not just a recipient of orders. Had I been that, I would have been an imbecile. I was an idealist. Did Hannah Arendt misread this man or mistake his demeanor there for the real deal?
It's a fascinating and important question. And one of the things that's happened in the last number of years is these tapes that you're referring to, which is an interview by a man named Wilhelm Sassen, have come to light. And by the way, she read transcripts of parts of those tapes, which were published in Life magazine. It wasn't a secret to her. But some other parts of the tapes have come to light, and people have pointed to them and have said, oh, he was much more of an anti-Semite than she understood. And one can say, but what's interesting is that a lot of the reviewers of the film and people, and not just the film, of her, have said, oh, well, she got Eichmann wrong, but she got the main point right. Evil is banal in the sense that it takes banal, thoughtless people to do evil, but she was wrong about Eichmann. And I think this has become a common sense response to her and to a certain extent to the film in many reviews. And I think it's a mistake, and it's in a complicated way. You have people like Stanley Milgram who did these experiments in which he asked people to answer questions right or wrong and had test subjects and said to them, apply shocks if they get the wrong answer. And these people applied nearly lethal and sometimes lethal shocks to thought they were doing it. They were actually actors. And so there's this one group of psychologists say it's all situation. People just do whatever they're told to do. And the other group now is the anti-situationalists are saying, no, you have to have some sort of anti-Semitism. You have to have some sort of predisposition to hate in order to do what something like Eichmann did, and that these Sassen tapes show that he did. Well, this is an argument that I don't find all too interesting. It's probably some of both. And this is why I think it's always a mistake. Of course, Arendt knew he was an anti-Semite. the first part of Origins of Totalitarianism is on anti-Semitism. You can't – it was a part of that world. And he did boast about being an anti-Semite, and he did boast about being a Nazi. The question is, did he do that because he was a Nazi and he was talking to Nazis? Sassen was another Nazi, as were the other people in the room. Is he someone who was more of a joiner? Is he someone who was a nobody and took on whatever worldview he was around because that was how he felt important? Or was he someone who was a virulent sociopathic or, you know, world leader, creative leader man? And Arendt, impression of him, an impression that you can only – you can't do this abstractly. You have to look at him. And that's why it's so important that Pam and Margarita von Trotta put the images, the actual film in their film.
Yeah.
Because you have to look at the man and ask, is this someone who you think of as a Hitler, or is this someone you think of as a nobody, a clown, a buffoon, as she called him? And that's the question that needs to be asked.
I guess when you see Hitler's passion in his speeches, which you've all seen, just, you know, almost mad with passion, what does it really matter if this functionary was a drone? He was executing a terrible passion, a genocidal passion, Pam.
Well, first of all, we never could have made this film without using the actual footage from the trial, because I think it, first of all, gives the audience the opportunity to think about her confrontation with Eichmann and
it's
make
amazing.
Up their own mind.
Yeah.
And I think that that's very important. So why does it matter? Because when you're trying to explore and understand a phenomena of totalitarian evil, the evil of National Socialism, I think it's extremely important to think about motive and its role or the lack of it. As Hannah Arendt pointed out, it's certainly important in a courtroom to consider motive. And it's certainly important when you're exploring the nature of evil. As your first caller wrote down, I think she shared his terror. And she was trying to understand it. And I wanted to say that the film gives us the opportunity to explore the active life of a thinker. And we didn't only pick this time because it was explosive and filmable, although that was very important. But it's also, I think, the concept of the banality of evil, which she discovered via her confrontation with Eichmann, is a gateway to many of her very important ideas, as we've heard Roger discussing. So I think it's deeply important to understand the people who committed these acts.
She grew up in a very secular family, agnostic. I mean, at one point you have someone in the film confront her and say, she studied, of course, with Martin Heidegger, confront her and say, you've adopted the kind of posture of the German. Looking down on the Jews. Of course, the other controversial part was saying that Jewish leaders could have done more to resist and less to cooperate with the logistics of the roundup that led to the Holocaust. Let's go to our listeners. Yehuda is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Yehuda, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
I actually grew up – my name is Yehuda. I grew up in Israel while the trial was broadcast everywhere. You couldn't really avoid it.
It was a big deal, a global phenom. Hmm?
Yes, and I read later on when I was a little bit older, in my early 20s or late teens, I don't remember, Hannah Arendt's book, and it evoked a very ferocious attack on her, especially I recall very distinctly a scholar that I admire whose name is Gershom Scholem.
Mm-hmm.
He was in Hebrew U, and he is a founder of Jewish mysticism as a discipline of study. And of course, there were also talk about the fact that she was close to Heidegger, her advisor, maybe too close. But as far as I'm concerned, I read both of her books. The first one was The Banality of Evil. And this is a book that I always go to when I see evil around me. It influenced me profoundly. I keep it near me. And after the Boston Marathon bombing, I remember that I talked to someone and I recommended to him to read Hannah Arendt, The Banality of Evil. And to me, I was always surprised by the ferocious attack on her, because when I really saw and listened to Eichmann, I just got the impression which was identical to hers.
But banal, I mean, think of the Boston Marathon bombings. You're in that neighborhood,
yes.
Yehuda, and you look at the videos of those young men setting down their backpacks amid families and children, but just calmly with their baseball caps on. It can look banal. But the results there, and how much more in the Holocaust, were surely monstrous.
Yes, except that I think that sometimes it's being misconstrued, that they were functionaries that were really close to the Holocaust and to the extermination, and I'm really a son of people who really went through it.
Yes.
And yet they just were functionaries, and in fact sometimes I think that I read somewhere that Himmler, when he saw sometimes the gassing of the Jews, vomited. So to me, I think that the notion that evil has this kind of ferocious face and he knows what he is, what I think I got from Hannah is that people can do the most horrendous things and yet be vegetarian and loving dogs,
yeah,
as Leibovitz pointed out about Hitler, and loving children, and yet be really basically the epitome of evil. In other words, I don't put a face on evil that is going to resemble evil.
Yehuda, you're a close reader and a good one, and I appreciate your call. Let me get one more, and we'll come to it all. Thank you, Yehuda. Marilyn in Newton, Massachusetts. Marilyn, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a little anecdote about Hannah Arendt, the person, which is far removed in a way from what you've been saying. I just do want to say, having heard your conversation before, that the next last time I saw Hannah Arendt was in the mid-50s, but the last time was in 63, and I had picked her up. And she was coming to Boston, and the first thing she said to me was, "You know, I don't understand. I never intended to hurt the Jewish community." So I just want to say that. But what I did want to say was, to give another perspective on her as a person, was that I was kind of a mentee of hers. In 1952, I was first graduate in philosophy at Brandeis University, and I was sent to her by an old colleague of hers whom she knew in Europe. And it took me a couple of months to get up the courage to go see her. And then we spent many, many, many afternoons in Morningside Heights talking, and she was marvelous to me. Now, one day she said to me, because she knew I was interested in the French philosopher Mirabeau Bonty, that she wanted to help me write for a Fulbright to go to France for a year and to study with Mirabeau Bonty. And I was terrified because I was a little hick from Dorchester. And I just felt, even with my college education, that I wasn't ready. And I told her so. And she said to me, "My dear, you are not going to France primarily to study." "No, well, why?" She said, "First, you're going to go and understand what beauty is," and which sort of made me a little resentful. I thought I knew what it was. And then she said, "And besides, you need a lover." Well, it was 1952. I was shocked. And I looked at her and I said, but I'm planning to get married. And she said, "Oh, marriage." She said, "Let me tell you what marriage is. It's like living on the edge of a knife."
Marilyn, you were face to face with a little piece of Europe right there. I don't know about beyond that, but she felt the anguish that many Jews felt toward her when she told you she didn't mean to hurt them. Clearly, it was hurting her.
Absolutely, absolutely, yes.
Marilyn, thanks for your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about German-Jewish emigre intellectual Hannah Arendt, political theorist famous for the phrase, "the banality of evil." A new film is out, Hannah Arendt, a biopic on that period of her life when she covered the trial of Adolf Eichmann in Jerusalem for The New Yorker. It raised a great furor over her interpretation of the trial, of the atrocities of the Holocaust and World War II. Pamela Katz is co-screenwriter of that film. She's with us from New York. Roger Berkowitz is here from Bard College. We're going to go to Israel in just a moment here. A little bit more from the film. Here's a scene in the new film where a Professor Miller, a kind of fictionalized compilation of the academic community that turned against Arendt after Eichmann in Jerusalem, confronts her in a lecture that she gives to her students at the New School in New York, where she publicly addresses criticisms of her report.
Miss Arendt, You're avoiding the most important part of the controversy. You claim that less Jews would have died if their leaders hadn't cooperated.
This issue came up in the trial. I reported on it, and I had to clarify the role of those Jewish leaders who participated directly in Eichmann's activities.
You blame the Jewish people for their own destruction.
I never blamed the Jewish people. Resistance was impossible. But perhaps there is something in between resistance and cooperation. And only in that sense do I say that maybe some of the Jewish leaders might have behaved differently. It is profoundly important to ask these questions, because the role of the Jewish leaders gives the most striking insight into the totality of the moral collapse that the Nazis caused in respectable European society. And not only in Germany, but in almost all countries. Not only among the persecutors, but also among the victims.
Barbara Sukova up there playing Hannah Arendt in the new film, Hannah Arendt. I want to go to Tel Aviv right now and Natan Schneider. He's professor of government and society at the Academic College of Tel Aviv Yafo, author of Jewish Memory and the Cosmopolitan Order, Hannah Arendt and the Jewish Condition. Natan Schneider, thank you very much for being with us from Tel Aviv today.
Hello, I'm glad to be with you.
You wrote a pretty tough review of this film. You said you know Roger Ebert. But you say that the new film boils down to German fantasies being taken for history. What do you mean, Natan?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, the movie, I saw it in Germany the first time, I saw it in Israel the second time. It's an interesting movie. It's a failure, in my opinion, a noble failure, but still a failure. I see it as part of a generation of German intellectuals who want to deal with Jewish history, the history of the Holocaust, with Jewish intellectuals in a way that makes them more than they want to be, more than they can be, identified with them. What you see in the movie is a German attempt to identify with Hannah Arendt, and it's done against the Jews. It's playing out, Hannah Arendt is being played out against the Jews. I don't know if you've noticed in the movie, all the Jewish friends are depicted in very stereotypical way. Hans Jonas, who's a very serious philosopher, comes off as a complete sentimental clown who suffers like from heartache and has no really serious thing to say. And I think it's, I mean, there are many other things that, you know, the stereotypical depiction of Israel, which is done where you see only old soldiers or Orthodox Jews, like in every other kind of stereotypical depiction of Israel. And the Israeli friends, the Jewish friends, all a big stereotype, and it's the German Jewish woman who has to tell the Jews how to think correctly about the Holocaust. That's really, I saw it as something very typical. I didn't think this is a coincidence. I saw it as something typical. It has been done in Germany by intellectuals with figures like Adorno and Horkheimer and others, were sort of like a German milieu identifies with these Jews, become like that.
Natan Schneider, let me ask you, if I may, in Tel Aviv, in that critique of the film, are you essentially critiquing Hannah Arendt herself? I mean, she was a very secular German Jew.
Not at all.
What's the difference then?
I'm critiquing Margarete von Trotter's picture and imaging of Hannah Arendt.
I understand that.
I think that Hannah Arendt is much, much smarter, that she was much smarter than she comes off in the movie. I think that that's what was so disappointing about the movie. He was one of the greatest thinkers of the 20th century, and she comes off as banal in that movie. Her sentences are sort of like completely taken out of context from her writings. And, you know, we're supposed to be in the presence of great thought, but we're actually not. And this is very upsetting. And you have here a woman who has written the really important books. Roger mentioned The Origins of Totalitarianism,
yes.
The Human Condition,
yes.
On revolutions and others. And, you know, that can be only We only get to know her through that one book that made the biggest fuss. It made the biggest fuss. It didn't make the biggest intellectual impact.
Pamela Katz in New York, if I may bring it to you. You know, Natan writes, in this film, Hannah Arendt becomes a German woman saving the Jews. He says that, you know, Germans love the story when told this way. What do you think of that criticism, Pam?
Well, let me start out by what he and I agree on, which is clearly very little. But what we do agree on is that she was one of the most important thinkers of the 20th century. I think I myself am having kind of a Hannah Arendt moment because I'm a Jewish American. My father was a German Jewish emigre, but I grew up here, and I wrote this film together with Margarete von Trotta. And during the process of the filmmaking, we met with Laura Jonas, Lotte Kühler, Jerome Cohn, Elizabeth Young Bruhl, and Roger Berkowitz, and many, many other people. And we worked very hard to give an, let's say, truthful presentation. So I don't think, in fact, that her writings are taken out of context. I think they're placed in context in an intelligent way for the greater public. I think we made as intellectually dense a film as was humanly possible, and still a film that people are clearly flocking to see. I think it's also important to invoke Elizabeth Young Bruhl here, the very brilliant biographer of Hannah Arendt, who wrote a fantastic essay called Why Hannah Arendt Matters Today. And she said, if you take the phrase "the banality of evil" and you remove it from the soundbite circuit and you unpack it, it can be a gateway to some of Hannah Arendt's deepest and most profound thoughts. And that was the intellectual goal of the film, to take that phrase and use it as a gateway to many of her more profound thoughts. And I should say the discussion the film has provoked all over Europe, including Germany and France, and it's beginning to provoke here, is bringing these ideas back into the popular imagination. It's taking it out of the small arena of intellectuals. That's my first answer. My second answer is because I also worked on Rosenstrasse with Margarete von Trotta. Yes. And that's also a case where the Aryan women who were married to their, mainly women married to their Jewish husbands, went out into the street and protested in 1943 when they were imprisoned and then some of them deported. And we heard that again, aren't you whitewashing history? And I would refer here to Peter Schneider, a very interesting German intellectual who wrote a book called The Good Germans. And he makes the point that so many people said, what could we do? There was nothing we could do. And when you find out that it was possible to help, it's not a whitewashing of history. It's a far greater indictment. And that's not to say that the expectation would be that everyone was a hero, but it was possible for some people to behave heroically, to, as Hannah Arendt said, and as I think the film makes clear, to think for yourself, to think independently, to figure out the difference between right and wrong. She says at the end of the film, thinking can prevent catastrophes. And I think that makes her sound very intelligent.
Natan Schneider, I want to bring this back to you in Tel Aviv, but if I may, at the same time, a lot of our listeners are interested in the current application of this kind of thinking. Let me bring a couple in. Steve in Brattleboro, Vermont. Thank you for calling, Steve. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Tom. That was a fascinating discussion. The book, I Can Jerusalem, had an enormous impact on my life. It was assigned to me in college in the 60s, around the time when the Vietnam War was going on. Mm-hmm. And it made it impossible for me to participate in that particular disaster. And many other times, the idea of banality of evil has just come back to me. And one that really strikes me now is the Bradley Manning trial. It seems to me that the whole defense should be, here's the book, Eichmann in Jerusalem. I mean, here's a young man who was confronted with incredible evil, and he said, no, I have to put this out. I have to do something. He may spend the rest of his life in prison. Who knows? But the reality is, for a moment, this young man basically said, no, I'm not going to be a cog in this machine. I know that helicopter gunships are killing civilians. I know this is going on, that's going on. So I think it's a profound book. I think it's wonderful that the film's coming out now, because now I can talk to my son and to other people and say, this is who Hannah Arendt was.
Yeah, Steve, I appreciate your call. Natan Schneider in Tel Aviv, you're listening there. What about Hannah Arendt's book, her story, her thinking as an inspiration, a challenge now to people to step up if and when they see what they see as evil and challenge it? Do you think the film helps provoke that response or might?
I don't think so. I mean, frankly, I don't think that this is an inspirational movie. I mean, I think it tries to be an inspirational movie, but I think it fails here too. And, I mean, people may go and flock to it and they may love it. And there's something profoundly wrong with that movie. I mean, I try to put it on paper, but I think there's really something profoundly wrong with it. Also because, in many ways, there's something profoundly wrong with Arendt's understanding of Eichmann during the trial. But that's something else. She couldn't know the real Eichmann. And she might be right about... She might be right about many other perpetrators of the Holocaust, but that's not the point. I mean, he was clearly a clown and a buffoon in the courtroom. He wasn't when he was in his real life. He was not thoughtless. He was rather thoughtful. He liked what he was doing. He was engaged in trying to destroy the Jewish people. I mean, that was he was a man. He was a man on a mission, clearly. But what I found extremely problematic is that the movie is used as many times the book is used. And Arendt didn't agree about that certain kind of application of the book. A certain point of, like, universalization, that everybody is a little bit Eichmann. You just need the opportunity, sort of like... You heard before about the Milgram experiment and all that.
Yeah.
You know, when could we jump in here?
One moment. Yeah, Roger Berkowitz, what do you think of these two interpretations or visions? What are you hearing as we hear Pam and Natan work this over?
Yeah. Well, I think there's. Hi, Natan. How are you? These are very complicated questions. Natan just said something that Eichmann was a very thoughtful person, and part of what we have to hear. Unpack, and it's a very difficult issue, and it leads to a lot of confusion. Is what thinking is, and what it means to be a thoughtful person. You know, Pam said before that Arendt says that thinking can inoculate us or save us from doing evil, and it's a very easy thing to say. Arendt said it, but what does it mean? What is thinking? And it's not always so obvious. We think thinking is something we all do, and Eichmann clearly thought in that sense. But for Arendt, thinking is something that. Is about self-thinking. It's about being independent. It's about standing apart from others. It's about not giving in to conventions and the way things are going. She talks in her book, and it's one of the...
What Eichmann did? I mean, Roger, you're describing the man Eichmann.
Well, I don't think so. But she talks about someone else in her book named Anton Schmidt, who was a German soldier who helped save numerous Jews. Risked his life to do it, and then was executed for that. What she sees is she says if people we need examples of people who think, who stand apart, and who don't just do what they're told. And you know, your caller, very good point, but your caller brought up Bradley Manning, and another caller brought up the suicide bombers. I mean, Bradley Manning, an interesting figure, but. Very different from Ellsberg. He didn't, you know, work to try and expose it first. He didn't discriminate about what he was going to release, sending it to an editors who would decide what to publish and what not. He released it all. He released a ton of data. You know, he may have stood up for injustice. I don't know exactly, you know, his entire thought process, but he didn't do it in a way that might be seen by people to be as thoughtful and deliberate as others might. And what the Arendt movie really does is confront us with Hannah Arendt herself. And this goes back to what Pam said very early. She went to this trial seeking to understand, and the movie is about her trying to understand. Thinking is a very hard thing to describe, but the movie, in minutes of silence with her thinking, but also in her words, is an attempt to say, this is what thinking is. You have to, in a sense, be willing to be attacked. You have to be willing to say things that are unpopular. You have to be willing to be arrested if that's what's going to come to, or be killed. Because thinking means you stand on your own. That's inspirational.
Not everybody is Hannah Arendt when it comes to thinking. Natan, what about Arendt in Israel today? Is she read? Is she published in Hebrew? We know for a long time.
She's read and published in Hebrew. I'm teaching a seminar on her books where I can use most of her things now in Hebrew. And Eichmann in Jerusalem, by chance, is the first book that came out in Hebrew in 2000. And now more and more books are constantly being translated. Of course, it doesn't steer controversy. It did in the old days because books don't steer controversies anymore.
Yeah.
But films do.
Yes, but films do. That is a good point. I'm afraid that's as much time as we have today. What a deeply fascinating life. What a deeply fascinating thinker. Even the film provokes interesting conversation wherever you come down on it. Natan Schneider with us from the Academic College of Tel Aviv, Yafo, in Tel Aviv. Thank you very much for joining us today, Natan.
You're welcome.
Roger Berkowitz at Bard College, the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities there. Roger, thank you to you.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And Pamela Katz, co-screenwriter of Hannah Arendt, just out in limited release. Thank you, Pam.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.